Welcome back to another Gab and Jules Meets. Jules, it's not often that we have the opportunity to talk to somebody who was, even though recently retired, a legendary footballer in the Premier League, literally made Premier League history. I now can look at it from the other side as well, now that he's a manager, and really takes us in so many different directions beyond football. Like, somebody who actually thinks about this and doesn't speak in terms of cliches. And that man, of course, is...
Vincent Kompany. I'm the manager of Burnley Football Club.
That sounds good. It sounds good, doesn't it? It sounds really good, man.
Do you sometimes forget? Like, is it like something that seeps into you? Like
that I'm a manager?
This is my job now?
Now you're the,
when you're out
the
there
boss,
and you see them?
No, I forget sometimes that I was a player.
Really?
Yeah, that's how much you're invested into the job. So my life has just shifted from being a player to being a manager. And the things you do have is like, especially when your players are going through situations, then you can relate. You can say, hey, I went through this. Or one of my coaches, because they've all played professional careers as well, they went through it and you relate. But my life is just, it's changed now.
I wrote a book with Gianluca Vialli many years ago, and he talked about the same thing about the transition. And he was also player manager for a while too with Chelsea. And he said one of the most difficult thing was that, you know, as a player, obviously, and as a leader, you know, you're concerned with your teammates and so on. But ultimately, being a high level athlete, so much focus on yourself. Am I eating right? Did I train well today? What can I do better? Do I sleep well? And then you become a manager, and you have inputs from, he says, it's not just 20 players. It's also my assistants, the director of football, the travel, the bus guy. And you don't have time, or it's much more difficult to carve out time for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, and there's one particular thing you mentioned is player coaching. So if I could have done a documentary at any point in my life, it would have been of that period of my life. Player coaching, it's surreal. And to in terms of, you know, executing and delivering the job, I thought I did really well. But then the hardest part was injuries. So player coaching in itself, it's actually feasible. You know, you're a captain on the pitch, and off the pitch, you give instructions about how you're gonna, you know, get to a result. And then even making decisions on players, you know, if you're fair, it's fine. But then being a player coach and being injured was like, that was something I didn't account for.
Do you think that was a mistake, maybe, that you should have either just be the manager or still maybe one more scene as a player? Or the fact that you could do both was a bit difficult for you just to manage in general?
Yeah, it was difficult, but the decision got a little bit imposed on me because... I didn't feel ready to stop. So that's always difficult. And at the same time, I felt that if I was going to a different place, especially with the level of instructions I received from Pep at the time and stuff, is I didn't really feel like I wanted to be coached anymore.
Right.
And that was the opportunity that allowed me to still, you know, continue both ways a little bit. And honestly, it was fine. I learned quickly. I learned a lot. But the difficulty was, like, if you're injured, like, you go in the stands. So as a coach, you can't be on the touchline. And then everybody's looking like, make sure he doesn't give any instructions to the team because you're not allowed. Yeah. Your status doesn't allow you. And so in the end, you know, in the first season where I did the player coaching, the role of coaching really changed into more, you know, kind of mentoring from the side and then leaving another person take charge of the coaching. But it prepared me well for becoming a manager. I mean, I stepped into management and it's as if I did it for 10 years because of, you learn quicker.
Because the decision to come here, it's big. It's a big decision, to be fair. It's a big club. It's a club that you need to bring back to the Premier League. It's a new squad. It's like, you know, you have to do the transfer, the recruitment, put everything in place, all of that. It takes courage to accept. You could have stayed where you were, really.
Yeah, and well, do you know, I think my time was done in Belgium. You know, Belgium, Anderlecht's a big club. It's comparable to like what you can experience in Barcelona, but in small, what you can experience maybe in Marseille or in France, you know? And so 3 years is a very long time. And I was really lucky because I worked with big talents, players that have done really well now that are dotted around on the European scene. So you always take a lot of pride in that. But my time was done. And then I had the decision to make because I had some opportunities abroad as well, like in the first division in top five leagues. Really good opportunities that everybody would say, well, it didn't make sense. You go and do it there. But I chose for people. I made a conscious decision and I said, look, I don't want to be a manager just 5 or 10 years and then I'm bored of it. You know, I want to be in football for the next 40 years of my life. So I'm patient. I'm in no hurry to lift all the trophies. I want to be successful. Success is not defined by trophies if you have a top five budget. if not, you know, success is defined by overachieving on the resources you have, by creating a squad that can have a clear identity and overperform. And then the decision to come to Burnley was for me just I chose for people. You know, I signed a
feeling you had with the people at the club that you were talking to.
Yeah, that's it. I didn't look at location. Was a coincidence that we are 45 minutes away from Manchester, but it was a coincidence. I wanted to commit to something that in my head, I have the feeling that I don't look stupid if I'm trying to build for the next 5 or 6 years. You know, like if you start as a coach, if you think about more than 1 year, everybody say, what are you doing? Think about more than 1 year. Be lucky if you're there by Christmas. And I can accept the reality, but I wanted to have a starting point where I could live from a different reality, which is, you know, build a squad. And you say we have to go up, but we never say it internally. Yeah. No, we...
But I'm interested in this as a... Because obviously there's a massive contract between Anderlecht where, you know, you can play European competitions and whatnot. Here you're coming into a club that has just been relegated.
Yeah.
You're replacing, I guess he left during the season, but a guy who in Sean Dyche had been here for a very long time. There's a change of ownership. There's a fan base that I'm sure they're very loyal, but they were also accustomed to seeing Burnley often as underdogs, but not just play in the Premier League, but do well in the Premier League for a long time. Yeah. You have parachute money for a while and you have resources. And then after that, I don't follow the championship very closely, but I know that it is 24 clubs.
Sure, it's a great league.
And, you know, more than half of them spend crazy amounts because they have, in my opinion, crazy owners who think, oh, let me buy a lottery ticket to the... I'm saying it's a tough, tough place and one that in some ways you're unprepared for after... City and Anderlecht, where you're at the top, no?
Yeah, so that's the perception thing with Anderlecht. So the perception is that this was a club that is big name and stuff. But with Anderlecht, really what happened is, you know, you talk about overachieving on resources. We were number 5 or 6 in terms of resources, but 1 in terms of perception.
Yeah.
So that's already a bad balance to start as a coach. So you have that pressure, but we had one of the youngest squads in Europe finish third, one of the youngest squad again, then finish third again. And we, in fact, we overachieved and we created a lot of value for the club who had a lot of debt to repay. So we made the club healthier. We created a lot of value and sold our players when we didn't even replace them. And so I take a lot of pride in the work that was done there. For me, it was terrific. But it was a very good learning school, in fact, for Burnley, because every single season I had to lose 10 or 12 players and I had to replace them with very little resources. And so you become creative and you're looking for players who can execute tasks rather than players who already have a big name, which is exactly what we've done now with Burnley. So And the level are very comparable. So between the first division in Belgium and the championship is bigger and faster and more athletic perhaps. But in terms of talent, in terms of potential, it's very similar. So it prepared actually quite well for this league. And And then you mentioned parachute money. Our parachute money got swallowed up by the debt repayment that Burnley had to do, you know.
I wasn't going to go there, but yeah, it did.
Yeah, but I think we feel comfortable to communicate about this because we've said we want to be open and transparent as much as we could. This is why as well, because the parachute repaid the debt and we lost all of our key players, Ben Mee, Tarkowski, Dwight McNeil,
Collins,
Nathan Collins, Nick Pope, Cornet, yeah. They all went. If you look at Norwich, Watford, the teams we're competing with, they kept most of those players. You know, they all went. So that pressure to say we have to promote that's not how we started this journey. What we did is like there's good examples, Brentford's and Brighton's, who've done it over a period of time, and you build a squad with players who hopefully the fans find exciting and they can already perform, but as well they can create extra value, and of your own resources you become a better club over time. We're a little bit ahead of time, but that
one. Yeah, because it's going great so far. So
yeah, it's been great so far. Yeah,
I'll knock on wood for you.
Yeah,
thank you.
How have you gone through those 4 months then, with the success on the pitch, with the way the team has been playing, far more possession? I mean, you're the team with the highest possession in the championship, for example. It's impressive, 63%, I think I was looking last night. 65. So your philosophy and how you felt in those 4 months?
It's obviously easier to bring in a kind of an attacking-based type of game than go into a defensive-based club. It's easier to bring an attacking football type of style.
Do you think? Because you would think the other way around, I guess. You could have kept them as a defensive team.
Yeah, but from the players, and you'd never feel resistance from having more of the ball.
Yeah, true.
You know, we all grew up playing in the parks, and you know, when you play with your friends, you don't give the ball away to the opposition and say, you play and we'll just defend.
Sure.
That's why no one wants to be a goalkeeper. and so that side of the game was easier to bring because I think, you know, naturally you're given more of the ball, but then you still have... You know, the target is to score goals. The target is to create chances, and you know, you convince them with time. You know, they realize the spaces. They try and they make mistakes, and then when they're successful, you show them again. And especially with having brought in 16 new players, I think you make sure that the players you bring in are comfortable in doing what you want them to do. And but then Burnley, the key thing I think for people here is, it's not so much about attacking or defending. It's about, you know, this spirit that you can bring to the game. Like, you cannot be at Burnley if you don't work hard. It's impossible. So we want good footballers. We want to have the ball. We want to attack and score. We want to press. We want to be aggressive as well. Like, it's so important. And we want to make the fans feel that if we've lost, you know, they'll forgive us here. But if we've lost, we've given everything we have and we move on to the next game. I mean, this is core. And I didn't install that here. That was there before me because Sean Dyche did a very good job at doing that.
I want to ask about that. We all have ideas, right? We all had favorite footballers growing up. And I'm not picking on him. But I'm thinking of Rick Elmay, right? We all remember Rick Elmay.
Yeah.
And not what you would think is necessarily a naturally dynamic footballer, very talented genius, footballer, but he's a genius, right?
Yeah, unbelievable.
We all remember as kids looking at players who were such skilled players where it looked like they're just walking around the pitch and then 1 second they do something magical, right? So if we all had this as our ideas, I'm assuming people in Burnley maybe don't have players like that as their heroes. Maybe they do. Maybe they have Ashley Barnes. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm curious in that transition because in the modern game, and I think the Pep Guardiola at Manchester City said, I'm going to take all these skillful players and I'm going to make them work as hard as Burnley, right? That seems to run counter to sort of this myth, this legend. I mean, your heroes when you were a kid, I'm assuming we're more Rick Elmay than...
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
Especially coming from Anderlecht, so... Our respect and our idols were all these kind of flair players, and everybody else had to work for them. And then, but you go to watch them. Do you know what I mean?
But this is what I get. Then you make the flair player work as hard as your ugly center half.
Yeah.
How do you do that? How did you experience that before going to, before Pep came to City?
No, I never experienced it before him. You know, I've always been part of squads initially where, and I was, you know, I always remember Yaya Toure, unbelievable player, of course. And I told this story a few times, but you know, we're going. I think it's the very first title we win with City, and you know, we've just played United in, I think it's 3 games before the end of the season. We win that game, puts us level on points, and we have 2 more games left to play. And it's, I think, QPR, the last game, and Newcastle away. Newcastle, tough game. And before the game, he pulls me, said, Vinny, you know, well done. He said, you're heading balls all season and winning duels. But today, I take care of it. And I'm like, yeah, you fought it. You're going to take care of it. How did you know? Like, and little did I know, but boom, boom, 2 goals, right? So that was the nature of the game. You know, you work for these guys who give you in decisive moments and make the difference. And Kun was the one that did against QPR. But the difference is probably 20 points between when the team works hard with talent and when the team doesn't with talent. You know, you can still win league titles, but can you win them the year after? Can you win again? And then it becomes difficult to compromise.
So, for example, you sign Ian Madsen to say, for example.
Yeah.
When you come in, you say, listen, you're great, you're very talented. This is my philosophy. This is what I want you to play. But I warn you now, if you come here, if you sign for me and for the club, you will have to work super hard.
Yeah, but that's non-negotiable. And the first thing I say, it's, but with me, it's a little bit easier because you're in Burnley.
Yeah.
Like, what do you expect? Right? You know, you've got to work hard. And so that's easier for me. And any of the signs around the training ground is not about, you know, a player that's making a overhead kick. It's people working hard and people who are... So that's the basics. And then the rest of it as well is like, you know, mental flexibility. You got to be able to play inside as a fullback, outside as a fullback. You got to be able to overlap, underlap. And I think that in the future, very few fullbacks, for example, will come out of the academies and be tolerated without this flexibility. So it's also, and I'm not saying he could do it before, but he can do it now. And it's also a part of their development. So you also take them with, like, you're here to improve. And that's what I want you to be able to do by the time you leave this club. And that's what's going to make you better as well for the rest of your career.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So when we were preparing for the interview, I thought, what if we get someone who knows Vincent really well, who played with him, to ask him a question about maybe how he went from player to manager, what kind of advice he would give. So our friend Gael Clichy was really kind enough, obviously former teammate of company at City, was kind enough to send us this little question.
Yes, Capi. Hope you're good. We always had the question, you know, when you were a player, which advice would you have to a young boy who would love to make it as a player? Well, you're not a player anymore. You're a manager. So I would ask you, what kind of advice you would have to a young coach to come? Your best advice that you could give. I'm following you. Good luck, and you're doing great work. Speak soon, man.
Yeah, we'll be a top coach, no doubt. Yeah, he's got all the tools. And but this,
what's the most important advice for you?
But the advice is very similar. Is make sure the difference between your highs and your lows is as small as you can. It can be, and I mean, you know, emotionally as well. So One of the things that you have if you want to go to the top, especially as a player, because that I know, and I think as a manager, I'm just on a pathway hoping to get better every day. But there'll be days where the whole world says you're the best. How's your next training session? Because I know players, when they think they're the best, the next day they don't train the same way anymore, and that's when you catch up with them. How's your training session when you're getting dropped by the coach, or when you have an injury, or when everybody says you're not good enough? And then if I'm looking at the next day and you're training the hardest on the pitch and you're there still doing the basics that you did when you had everything to prove, then I know you'll get the most out of your career. And then the talent, you know, tells you already in advance if it's a player that can go to the very top or not. But the biggest mistake a lot of these young players make, I would say, in general, and that's why, to be honest, you feed off that as well. I mean, you get to the very top because people give up. It's not just yourself. Yeah, you do. So we're all talent. I mean, you go in Kinshasa in the streets and there's so much talent. You go in Colombia, there's talent there. You know, you can't tell me that they can't, you know, be the man 1v1 and receive a ball in tight space. There's 400 million people playing a game. So there's more talent than there are places in football. And talent is overrated and overpriced. But the mental aspect of it is, you know, how do you get to the very top? Is because when you have a bad day and I'm working hard, when you have a good day and you think, and I'm keep working, in the beginning, we start in a position where you might be ahead of me, but by the end of it, the gap is this big. Mm. And that relentlessness and that consistency, that's my best advice. Live in your bubble. Try not to fluctuate with the hype and the drama too much. Live in your bubble and do what you have to do to get better.
And same as a coach. You feel the same as a coach now?
Yeah, the same. But as a coach, I think you have to even show it more by example. So, for example, I'm just saying myself, but, you know, one part of our routine is, you know, we build up to the game by giving a game plan for each game, each phase of each game. And then after the game, we have a debrief. And of course, it's a little bit easier because you match the pictures against what you asked them to do before the game. And then it's quite objective as well. This is what we wanted you to do. This is what you did. And it's quite objective as well if you're wrong as a coach, because because you've given the wrong instructions. Everybody can see it. But it's something we do. But then the hardest part is, can you do it 46 games?
Yeah.
Can you do it for a League Cup game like we played against a League Two team? And that's what, for me, makes a difference. And if you do it 46 games and you do it for League Cup games and in friendly games, you have the same attitude and it's a way of living, then you should just feel comfortable that at one point you will see people, other people will tap out. And it's just time.
I'm curious about what you said about, you know, the role of talent and, you know, versus the mental side of it and how people enter the pipeline and become top flight footballers. Yeah. There's a question I ask everybody. I do have a follow-up.
You love this question.
I know.
Yeah. Literally everyone.
How old were you? And you have to be honest about this.
Yeah.
When you were suddenly not the best player on your team.
Anymore. So Zlatan said never.
Yeah.
Zlatan said he was always the best. So like, but objectively, was there time when
you came
okay.
through? Was it when you moved to Anderlecht? Was it later when you said? And obviously, yeah, you know, there might have been more skilled, more technically gifted, or whatever. But when you said people are just better than me.
Sami Khedira said, I think the Germany under 16 team, Kevin Prince Boateng,
yeah.
was just like Khedira said, I was really good.
Yeah.
But he said I saw him train and said, okay,
I met somebody much like, better than me.
Kevin Prince was just like better than me.
No, for me, about every year in the start.
Really? Even when you were even like
because
10,
you were a prodigy. When you went to Hamburg.
But because I was always put in categories above my age. So, you know, when I was 10, I was playing with the 12s. When I was 12, I was playing with the 14s. So I was always the one that had to work harder I was never the strongest one in the beginning. Talent-wise, maybe, because otherwise you don't get put in a high category, but I was never the strongest one. But by the end of the season, I was. and I felt the same when I went into the first team. And then when it was time, that's when I made the step. And I felt the same when I went to Hamburg. Was difficult because I had big injuries there. So yeah. That got in the way. But with City, I experienced it probably in 3 or 4 cycles like this. You know, the first time I got there, I felt comfortable straight away. Then comes the first wave of transfer. Nigel Young, Shay Given, Craig Bellamy, Adebayor. And I'm like, this is better than me. and then I just, you know, I grind my way through. And I was already a leader for that team as well. And then comes the next wave, Tevez, David Silva, and all these guys. And I'm like, you know. And it kept going. And then came the Pep era and so on. But I don't think I ever, I felt that they were, but by then I got in such a routine of like, okay, they're better than me right now. And then let's see at the end of the season. And that was how I think I was able to progress in this game.
But even when Pep arrived, you didn't feel like, okay, I'm established here. I'm the club captain. I've won titles already.
No, because the way he came in as well, it's like everything he brought in had nothing to do with what we did before. So there was like a new kind of order coming in, you know, trophies, it doesn't matter. He's won more than everybody else, you know. And also I think the way he played, none of us really had been able to show whether we were footballers that could do it or not, because we played in such a different way, you know. So everybody had to kind of prove himself. And then, of course, you got the first thing where, you know, you see fullbacks putting diagonal. You see fullbacks going into midfield, center backs sometimes being midfielders, and then you see these diagonals to the pockets, and you see this when you have to go to the play, and at the last moment you make a choice to pass forward or to pass sideways, and so on. So all these things, but I learned, and I had a very good football education that I received from Anderlecht, to be honest. That already actually was there somewhere in the background to help me out, of course.
I'm really curious about that you were questioning yourself and you had this and you used that as a stimulus, a drive you didn't take for granted. And you touched upon confidence before. One thing that I often find, having lived in England for many years, is when I see ex-players talk, and English ex-players especially, they always talk about the importance of confidence and like, oh, if he loses his confidence. I feel like, for example, England, the England national team, need confidence. Yeah. I'm Italian. We do the opposite. We produce when everybody says that they're rubbish, when the president of the club sends the ultras to the training ground. Yeah. I don't know if Burnley's ultras ever come here to scare the players into getting a result in the big derby. It's almost like they want to knock you down to get a reaction. That's one way of motivating people. The other way is telling them, you're good enough, you're smart enough, you got this, it's going to be fine. Obviously, you're going to tell me, as a manager, maybe you don't give the same message to every person. Maybe there's a balance in between.
No, I think you try and ride the wave a little bit of sometimes it's just a moment. The triggers could be different. It could be like a strong reminder. It could be an arm run. And I think, you know, these different, you try and catch the wave of what you think your team will respond to the best. But ultimately, you want performance. But I think confidence, and I'm a big believer in that. I think it can only be a bonus in your career. Anybody that says to me, I need confidence to play, I'm trying to make them feel, to make them understand how important it is to not rely on confidence. Because confidence comes and goes. You know, you could wake up in the morning, you have an argument at home with your wife, and your confidence could go. You know, and you, some fan could say you're the best, your confidence come back out, and there's a kid saying you're rubbish. It can go again. And like, it's such a treacherous friend, confidence. It will betray you. And I think your biggest tool, your biggest asset in your career is consistency. And the way you are, and also you can train yourself to be confident. And I think the way you train yourself to be confident is by being consistent in your routine and in your habits. And then when you get onto the pitch, you can have that arrogance because, hey, if you've done your preparation well, you know, I mean, you defend the colors of a club that represent your level, right? Mm-hmm. So why should you doubt that you're in the right place? And you go. And once, like I always had this thing, that's how I imagine the best, you know, those players would get better with age. And you had the examples of Pirlo and stuff. And I think I experienced it a little bit as a central defender myself as well, you know, because I was playing through injury. I was never physically 100% fit and I was able to perform. And the biggest thing that was is when I got onto the pitch, it became like, you live in a bubble almost, like where there's not a lot of noise, everything is calm, and there's not a lot of stress either. But everything you're trying to be a step ahead of, and that comes, I think, you train now. You know, experience is a big help, but the right habits towards it, it's not confidence. You know, confidence comes through that.
Company, the manager, is coming from the education at Anderlecht, from the education with Mancini, from the education with Pellegrini, from the education with Pep.
Yeah, all of them.
All of them.
Mark mm-hmm. Hughes.
Yeah, of course.
Because you've taken little things from, or maybe a bit more from someone, or how does the company manager work?
No, you take from all your experiences, and it's cliche, but you learn also from those that you didn't really appreciate. You know,
like, really?
Yeah, of course. This is what
but later on.
No, because you, I think that's also what drives you to be a manager. You got these guys who have taught you certain stuff. These guys who have done things that never made sense to you, and you're like, okay, like I want to have a go at like getting it right. Yeah. You know, we never get it right, but I think the idea is still that you learn from all the influences you've had in your life. Yeah.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart?
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
Throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
I had to ask him this because this has been a theme when great players become coaches. And it's interesting, obviously, he worked with Mancini, he worked with Pep. One of the frustrations of great players is that they're dealing with guys who are a lot worse than they were. Mm-hmm. And they may not be able to do some of those things. They may not be able to see some of those passes. So I had to ask Company how he dealt with that.
Yeah, like I was Messi or Ronaldo in my career, you know.
Mancini was. That's why he sees it a bit differently.
but I was a good player, but I was, you know, I've been at the very, very top. But the key part, I've never seen myself. My passion is around development as well.
Right.
And so you can put the standard so high for a young player, but you just gotta have the pathway. And then as well, you've got to monitor the standards, the habits, you know, that's the biggest thing to progression. It's like, okay, you fail. Like, have you been in the right position? So should I be lenient on the position or should I be hard on it? Of course, you're hard on the position, you know, like I'm most lenient about a guy. If a guy misses the goal from here to the camera, I don't get frustrated. I get frustrated if he's not in the right position. And
that's something he can control.
Yeah. And especially the way I think we select them, I think we feel comfortable that the players that we select have got a physical capacity to get there as well, which is an important thing of being in the right position. You have to be able to do it. So I focus on that. Have you been in the right position? Have you had the right, you know, body angle? Have you, you know, had the right approach to execute? I try and give advice on that. And I look, if you score 3 out of 10, and that's why you're with us. And when the day you score 7 out of 10, off you go. But you got to be in the right position. You got to have those 10 chances.
But you get frustrated because Mancini and Pep are tough. They can be tough. Are you tough as well? Or are you always trying to be
more nurturing?
More nurturing.
No, I think you have to make the assessment of what's the best version of you? What's the best version of you? And once you've got an idea of this, and you don't make your idea yourself. You know, I speak about every play with, you know, Craig Bellamy and Mike Jackson and my coaching staff, Floribert and Galula. And we've all played at different levels. And once we've got the assessment of what we think is one, the quality right now and the talents or the potential for the future, then you've got to be, you know, you've got to push the players. We're here to push players to their maximum of what they can do. Yeah.
It's funny. There's
a demanding on habits always. Like more than anything,
you have to, you have to demand.
Yeah. Forgiving, very forgiving. When the execution, is not perfect. If you've been focused 100% and if you've had your preparation perfect up to that point.
So you repeat the same drills at training, for example, a bit like what you would do with Pep, in the sense that you work on a pattern of play where, let's say, your right back comes inside, and then you do that again and again and again until they almost don't think about it. They just do it naturally.
Yeah. I think it's more about spaces though. So Pep is the one who revolutionized with it. For me, it's just, you know, it's an understanding of the game now for me, where you think about spaces and players have got to be comfortable to be inside, outside, and they will train in all these different roles more than position.
Okay.
But yeah, you have a lot of pattern play. You have pattern play for defensive side. I still think live is always the best way to improve, but managing load and stuff nowadays, you can't always do it. And you try and build a little bit of a curriculum, if you can say it this way, towards your ideal of the game. Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned roles instead of positions.
Yeah.
I did a story a year ago. These people it was analytics based, but they did a study, and essentially they're big proponents. It's a guy who worked with Mancini, actually with the Italian Federation. Big proponents of the idea that we shouldn't think about positions. Mm-hmm. We should think of roles, that players have different characteristics. So, you know, Haaland and Aguero both are center forwards, but they interpret the game differently. So they create a category. So you buy into this. Yeah.
But I think it's just logic. You can call it a position, it's still a role. You know, you can have a fullback that you call, you know, you can call a fullback, but the role, if you decide that the role is inverted, then that's the role. If you decide that the role is on the outside, but the profile has to match the role more than the position. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So whatever, you play a 4-4-2, you have a winger. The winger can be a wingback in a 4-4-2. All he has to do is on the side of the ball to drop, and then he has to defend like a wingback. You know, it's whatever you call it to be. So that winger has to defensively still be aggressive and show signs of. So all these things are but then it's still task based. So what do you want the role? What do you want the task? What tasks are associated to the role? And then what does that player show you in terms of profile and what he's able to do and feel comfortable? You mentioned Haaland and Kun Aguero. It's more difficult for Haaland than maybe right now, you know, because he's still young, so young. He can get better in everything still. But maybe it's more difficult for Haaland to come, you know, and drop into midfield to be an extra man, whereas for Kun it was a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. And that type of idea, then you shouldn't box yourself in, but it gives you a little bit of, it fills pieces of the puzzle when you try and set up a game plan.
And then does that make talent ID for you as a coach, as a manager, even more important? I was talking to Arteta the other day, and I think he's got a lot of his talent ID. I mean, Zinchenko and Gabriel Jesus are the two biggest example, really, of exactly what he wanted from a left back that they were going to sign. And he would have never signed Roberto Carlos, even at his best, or Paolo Maldini, for example. However, Zinchenko ticked all the boxes of everything he wanted, so they went and get exactly the profile.
I still think he would have signed.
I know, me too. As I was saying it, I was like, okay, maybe not those two, but, you know, like, get a cliche, just for the joke of the friend. But you see what I mean? Does that make your talent ID, you and your recruitment team and your scouts and your spinner, whatever, even more important, because I want my right winger to be exactly like that. So I need the player that, you know, plays exactly the way or has the characteristic that I need him to be.
I think it's, but that does evolve to, it's not just that style of play. I'm sure if you go into Atletico Madrid and Simeone's team, I mean, you know, they defend a bit more compact, mm-hmm. but you know, there's volume, there's mobility, there is grit and aggressiveness, and then there's speed for transitions and all this kind of stuff. And then there's still games that they dominate where they need players that to receive between the lines, you know, because they're still not going to be the team to play long ball, second ball. And so I think as long as you've got that side of it very clear for yourself, then you'll find the players that you need. But in terms of also, like, good players adapt, you know, good players adapt. I mean, Kyle Walker was the classic fullback up and down. And you know, he became one of the best inverted fullbacks in the world. And if you ask him tomorrow to go on the outside, he can still do it. You ask him inside, he does it. Does he have to flatten off in part of the back line? He does it as well. And that gives you a little bit more control of the ball when they're good players. And I'm no doubt that Gael Clichy, if he was a little bit younger, would have done a fantastic job as well at it.
I mean, he still fancies himself as number 10, you know.
Yeah. It would have been perfect, in fact. It was just 10 years too late.
But I'm curious about that because, I mean, Walker's an excellent example. Yeah. I'll use a non-City one here. When you look at, when you do the talent ID piece, there's also an element of what the player is being asked to do by the system of the coach that he's in at the time. When you look at him, and you may have a different idea. I'm thinking of, for example, Andy Robertson at Liverpool, effectively, you know, there's some parallels, still plays wide, still on the left, but it's a different movement. It's a different, that's got to be the real skill, the real value added, that you can look at Kyle Walker and you can imagine, based on what Kyle Walker is being asked to do by his current manager, you can imagine him doing these other things, right?
Yeah. But the thing as well is, like, you got to be very creative, because I don't think any of us thought that Fabian Delph could have been a left back. I don't think he thought it. Yeah. Zinchenko was a number 10. So I remember the amount of hours we spent. And I spent quite a few hours with Zinchenko as well, and Delphi as well, because they were both playing left. And at that time, I was playing quite often on the left because we had two right-footed. And I remember thinking that cross is going to come over my head, and those two guys are behind me. So so we spent quite some time just at least just talking and going through some stuff and sharing experiences and about this thing. But the real idea that was, you know, obviously from Pep, you know, it takes a lot of creativity to do it, and you got to be brave to do it. And I mean, as well, you're going against so many perceptions. But in the end, it was logical, because these players gave us so much control of the ball. They were aggressive. They were on the front foot. By that time, we had 70% of the ball most games. So, you know, you defend transitions, you defend longer spaces. And the very few moments where you have to defend a bit deeper, usually you get away with it because the other team doesn't even see clear anymore. They just want to get rid of the ball. And so as long as it's clear, it made so much more sense to go more that way. And it was logical. And but yeah, I mean, there's the funny thing on fullbacks, it's still a perception thing, because, you know, I remember as well, obviously in Belgium, I had a few moments where I had to play with an inverted fullback. And it was like, well, fullbacks, no, you got to let them go. And the whole country, the whole football country in turmoil, because, you know, the fullback should be on the rail on the outside and go up and down. Whereas, you know, obviously the football culture in the bigger leagues is a little bit more evolved in that sense, but that was a kid. But what I wanted to say was more like, I had this discussion with one of the fullbacks, I won't say who at some point, but he was saying like, Vinny, why can't I go up all that? Why should I always stay back? And I say, well, and I remember there was a Nike box shoes. I was a player, by the way. And I was like, okay, so let's put the three positions up front. We got a winger, striker, winger. Then we got two number 10s. That's how we played. The two number 10s. And I said, okay, how many goals is that winger? It was about between 15 and 20 goals and about 10 to 15 assists. I said, how many goals is striker? 30 goals. How many goals and assists the wing on the other side? The same, 15, 20, 10 assists, 15 assists. And then the two number 10s, 15 assists, 10 goals, 15 assists, 10 goals, whatever. I say, and you as a fullback, how many goals and how many assists? And it was like, so why would it make sense to let you go there? These guys, you know, you're getting in the way. And he was like, okay, yeah, I get it. So I was really hard on this. So just give him the ball, let them go and score, and you know.
You're a player, where you said that as a manager, you might have used slightly different language, yeah?
Yeah, I was a player.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Jules, I'm so tempted to speculate about who he might be talking about.
I've got an idea.
I think I have an idea, but we don't necessarily want to go there. But I had to ask about something that, you know, having been to Belgium a lot of times, you're from the north of France, Paris,
of course,
right?
You're
nearly Belgian, right?
We are cousins.
I'm always struck by, it's a weird place in the sense they have like three different parliaments and like
languages,
you know, languages, and it's all these people coming together, and not to get too pretentious about it, but there is a cultural different. This is not a naturally united or culturally united country. And you know, when you play for your national team, you're representing your country as a whole. So I wanted to ask him a little bit about that dynamic.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that make Belgium particular. I mean, one is the fact that because we're a small country and we're so central, we're very open to different cultures. So it's very normal for us to go to London, to Paris, to Germany, and, you know, just do our stuff there. And that also transpired into football. So when the young players that you mentioned, that generation that you wrote a piece about in 2011, you know, a lot of these guys went through academies as well abroad. So because the border clubs are Lille, where Eden Hazard was, and then PSV Eindhoven, where I can't remember which player, but you had Ajax, and all these players, all these clubs on the border are so close.
Vertonghen and Alderweireld.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so we had our own academies with Anderlecht and so on, still being good academies, but also abroad, right near to the borders of the country, we had access to, you know, like top five league type of academies, and so all that talent just kind of benefited from this supercharged kind of education, and then we broke through at the same time as well, which created for me that generation.
Because many years ago, we used to speak about, you know, distinct styles and schools of football, and, you know, these are all stereotypes we've gone through. You know, England was long ball, Brazil was samba, Italy was catenaccio. I think we've all moved on from that. Unless you really are lazy, haven't been paying attention.
Yeah.
Everybody's evolved. But in some ways, Belgium kind of evolved first, because I always felt that over the years, you had some managers who were very defensive many years ago.
We were all about hard work.
But you always had the hard work. That is the one continuous thing, because sometimes with Roberto, I think you were more attacking than you had been. That's been the one continuous thing.
Yeah, I think we were all, but we were always the underdog. So usually in the big games, you know, we had to work hard to stay in games. And, you know, I've been a part of that Belgium generation as well. And it was more physical. It was more, and if we weren't on top, then teams would beat us quite comfortably. And then it evolved, I think, because, yeah, when you have players playing for the top four clubs in the Premier League, the top two, top three clubs in the other big five leagues, all of a sudden, and then we had Roberto come in as well at the right time, you know, just as that generation was peaking and having a more probably academic approach of the game for a team that was ready to absorb it. So then we started having possession, we started pressing, we started being the dominant team. But that journey still is still been like, it's been a long journey. I mean, the shift couldn't have been bigger.
But when you were like, because I was just curious, but when you were like 24, 25, and, you know, you were already established as a top central defender, and you see these guys who are 2, 3, 4 years younger than you coming through Hazard and De Bruyne and Lukaku, are you thinking like, yes, this is going to be really, really good. All these guys are coming to help me.
Yeah. So a little bit earlier to your prediction, I think I did an interview when I was 17. And I said in that interview, I was a kid, but I came through and I said, because everybody, Belgium, we always had that inferiority complex. You know, we're smaller and people abroad are successful, and we always say, you know, being normal is crazy enough. So, but, you know, obviously all the kids like me, I come a little bit from the street, you know, and, you know, I've never been brought up in this, you know, we've been brought up to be ambitious. And then as well, if you go abroad and stuff, that those kids that I mentioned that went to the leagues abroad and stuff, you know, your culture, your mentality changes on that. You break through those chains, if you like. But one of the biggest things I said when I was 2003 or something, I said, so in the youth teams, we would go on with Anderlecht, with very strong team, and beat, you know, any team we were facing, Real Madrid, Juventus, you know, Ajax and stuff, like really comfortably. So we had a strong generation already. And for what reason would we then get into the first team and all of a sudden we can't compete with these guys? You know, what changes from the age of 16 to 20 that all of a sudden they get better than us? And in the beginning, it was more like we all came in at the same time, which cost us a lot of points in the table. Like we were very, very bad for a long period of time because we were too young.
Yeah.
But then we grew for about 7 to 8 years together. And then 2014 to 2000, I would say, hopefully till now, that was that kind of, you know, we pushed through, but it took time, just time.
But can you work your head around why you haven't won a Euros or a World Cup? It's just little details at times, things didn't go your way. 2018, we were talking about before we started.
It's a tournament, you know, anytime you get a draw, you know, you're in the hands of luck, and it's a tournament competition. So, you know, Belgium has been number one in the world for how many years now? 6-7 years, like a really long time. So the consistency has been there, and they've been winning the groups comfortably for many years. But when you get into a tournament, there's like that group phase, and then you shuffle the pack and anything can happen. And, you know, margins like the World Cup in 2018, you're in the group stage, you've got the last game against England, and the losing team gets the better pathway to the final. And of course, what do? We go and win this game. And all of a sudden, you got Japan, Brazil, France, and then England again at the very, very end. And so every game was just tough for us in that tournament. And then being third is still a fantastic result. You can't win them all.
We joke about it, right? But if you think of the knock-on effect, I mean, Gary Southgate's talked about it, but just, you know, maybe if England win that game, maybe, you know, England don't go to the semifinal and Gareth Southgate doesn't emerge with all this credit and this self-belief. And then they don't reach the final Euros.
I'm fine.
And we won the Euros later.
Just saying.
But I'm saying, I always find it fascinating how we're talking about 7 games if you reach the final.
It's nothing.
It's nothing. And
no,
it's 1 month. It's 1 month, you know, I'm sorry, I hope you do well this season at Burnley, but it's entirely possible that you will have a spell of 7 games where maybe you lose 1 or 2 games.
Yeah,
and then it's still a great success.
Yeah, you have to actually consider this. And yeah,
we draw so many conclusions from this. This player is good. You know, in the past, they used to buy players on the back of a good World Cup.
Hey, don't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Don't make that mistake.
Don't. 7 games, it's nothing. And it's especially, The World Cup's not like anything else, and you really have to peak at the right time. It's not the group stages. It's, you know, like for us, even in that 2018 World Cup, that was actually a fantastic World Cup for us because we won so many games as well. But we really had to peak only in one game. It was the Brazil game. That was like, for us, we had to get to our best level because they were so good. And then like the France game is a set piece. It's a corner,
yes.
You know, and we have a corner where Toby Alderweireld does a fantastic header, I think it is, or a shot.
Yeah.
And Hugo Lloris makes like a save, and I was close by for me, he was in. And he makes a save, and that ball goes out. And then we've got a front post run, on a near post run on a corner. And those margins. But I'm someone, I love participating in tournaments. I love it. But I never draw conclusions from them. It's pointless. The best team in the world is not the team who wins the World Cup. No way.
I see what you mean.
It's very rarely the team that
unless wins. It's France, but
unless it's Belgium.
Can they do it this year? Do you think?
I think they can. Yeah, but I think they'd be comfortable saying that this other team's favorite as well. Mm. But they can. I think in the same way that Italy won the World Cup as well. You know, with an experienced team, being disciplined, organized, having the advantage of having played a long time together. And having game changers in the team, they've got match winners, and you need that in tournaments.
I mean, KDB, I just want your opinion on KDB. If he still amazes you now, you saw him really young. He grew with you at City. He's finished third in the Ballon d'Or. He can go higher. I think one day he can win it.
Yeah.
What's your relationship and what's your opinion about Kevin?
One has got this thing, which is, of course, very Belgian, is humble, and that makes him likable. But the thing as well is just his football brain. You know, and I've always said it, I think he would say it himself, but you give Kevin a team with a plan, and he will be directing the orchestra. And, you know, you got other players like Hazard is a good comparison, doesn't need a plan. Put him on the pitch and
he's the plan. Yeah,
he is the plan. But Kevin sees the plan. He closes his eyes and then he receives the ball and he executes and he knows before he gets the ball what he's going to do. You just have to run and get there. And that's very special. There's like a big part of his game that you don't see. that is even more special than what he offers when he has the ball.
Jules, we really enjoyed that, didn't we?
Wow, that was so good. I just think he's, one, he's very interesting. He's always been. He's have great reflections on the game as a player, as a former player, as a manager now. You could tell that he thinks a lot about things, and this is a big part of, I think, the manager that he's going to be. I've got to know that for me, that he's got all the potential, all the tools to be really, really good.
But I was struck by the thinking part, yeah. You know, because look, let's face it, Pep is one of his mentors, right? And one of the things that Pep gets criticized for when he doesn't win and doesn't lose trains, like, oh, he's overthinking. And
yeah.
I will never go and blame somebody for trying to be cerebral, trying to say, these are my experiences, somebody just hiding behind cliches and whatever. And Company certainly doesn't do that.
Thank you for listening and sharing that moment with Vincent Company with us. We heard from Pierluigi Collina not that long ago. That podcast that Gab and Jules meets with Collina is still available. Of course, like all the big archives that we have, from Gael Clichy to Zlatan Ibrahimovic to Sami Khedira to many others, they're all available if you enjoy this kind of format of long conversation. Yeah, exactly, where we take the time to look into subjects and discuss it with some of people acting in the game.
Real quick, what's the easiest choice you can make? Window seat over middle? Taco Tuesday over salad? What about selling with Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/gabjules, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/gabjules now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/gabjules.